United States stands with the people of Ukraine in their desire to make their own choices about their future and to be able to live their lives in a unified, peaceful, stable, and democratic Ukraine. The president said clearly, that is our only interest. That is what drives us. Not a larger strategy, nothing with respect to Russia directly. We are interested in the people of Ukraine having the opportunity to have their country's sovereignty and territorial integrity respected, as we would ask that to happen for any country.
Secretary of State John Kerry in London today. He spoke after hours of talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov about how to end the crisis in Ukraine. The discussions did not produce any agreement, and this weekend could raise tensions even more. On Sunday, people in Crimea will vote on whether to split from Ukraine. Crimea juts out from Ukraine into the Black Sea, and there's a long list of reasons this little sliver of land is important to both Ukraine and Russia. My next guest has spent a lot of time researching and thinking about Crimean politics. His name is David Besmozgis. He's a writer and filmmaker, and his new novel, The Betrayer, is set in modern-day Crimea. It comes out in September. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Well, tell us about Russian President Vladimir Putin's interest in Crimea now. Why is it important to him now? After all, Crimea has been part of Ukraine since 1991.
Well, it's hard to know exactly why it's important to him now, but it's been important to him always because of the Black Sea Fleet, which is stationed in Crimea, in Sevastopol, and has been for a very long time, centuries. So is it an opportunity for him now to make a grab for it because of what happened in Kiev with the revolution? It would seem like that's the excuse.
That's the excuse. And yet, though, for a very long time, Crimea has been important to Russia. It figures in a lot of novels. Chekhov has written about it, for example. And you, as a novelist, you were attracted to Crimea. Why?
Well, firstly, I just needed a place. Because of how my book is set, I needed a place which was a Russian summer resort, a resort that would have been a resort during the Soviet period. And there really aren't that many options. And the most prominent of them is Crimea, Yalta, primarily. It's very odd to watch news about Crimea in the winter, because for people who are familiar with it, know it really as a summer resort and think of it in terms of the beaches and just the warm weather of summer, and that's where you go. And that was really the main reason for choosing it to begin with.
But also you went there and did a lot of research in terms of the people who make up this region, and it's really interesting. It's such a stew of different interests, Jewish, Muslim. You've got the Cossacks as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, often when you make a practical decision for a book, you start to discover things that seem to meld very nicely with what you want. So Crimea has a fascinating history for a lot of reasons. You mentioned that there's a Jewish history that goes back a long ways. There's the Khazars, which were this mythical tribe that apparently all converted to Judaism, and they were in the Crimea. There was twice in the 20th century, Crimea was contemplated as an autonomous Jewish republic, and both times it ended tragically. And there has always been a large Muslim population there. I mean, before the Russians controlled it, it was part of the Ottoman Empire, and you have the Crimean Tatars, who also tragically in 1944 were deported en masse by Stalin and the Soviets to Central Asia, and many of them died en route. It was very terrible. And you still have this long-standing cultural and historical connection between Russia and Crimea, because until 1954, when Khrushchev decided to hand Crimea over to Ukraine, it was just part of the Russian Soviet Republic, and Russians had always lived there, and the Tsars had their summer palaces there, and the Crimean War was fought there, and during the Second World War, Sevastopol held out for nearly a year against the Nazis, and just so much Russian blood has been shed on the soil of Crimea that the Russians have a very close connection to it.
Yeah, you say, you write in a blog post in The New Yorker that all the time you were there, you don't remember hearing a single word of Ukrainian.
No, there's really almost nothing to identify this place as anything but Russian. That may have something with where I was, but I traveled fairly broadly. There was only in the interior where you felt more of a Tatar presence, that it felt kind of more like Turkey or Central Asia. But around the coastal towns were very Russian, and you just heard Russian spoken. And in that sense, I'm not at all surprised that there's this move to move closer to Russia. And again, as you were mentioning, there's also been a separatist movement there for a long time. Some of it was political. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a moment where nobody knew which way Crimea would go. And there's been a radical militant Cossack movement, training with training bases and training young boys for the ultimate battle to join Russia. And that's been there for a while, too.
And so your book, it's not a book of reportage, it's a novel. And so what kind of responsibility do you feel to capture the essence, the truth of this area and what's happening there? And as I understand it, it's set in present day. It is set now, your novel.
Well, the novel was supposed to be set in the summer of 2014. So it was actually supposed to be set, slightly in the future, when that's clearly not going to be possible anymore, because the Crimea of last year and the Crimea of next year are going to be very different places. But as far as the responsibility to what Crimea was like, it's a realistic novel. And so I wanted to capture this place, which has all these different, conflicting forces in it. And the one thing we also should note is that ruling over all these people is probably one of the most corrupt regimes, certainly in the former Eastern Bloc, maybe in the whole world, and resented by everybody. And I just never thought, even though traveling through the place and seeing how people were living, kind of subsisting, for the most part, I just didn't believe that, there'd be this sort of uprising.
So I guess your novel is going to be set further in the future now.
Set much further in the future, or it's going to be set, slightly in the past, unfortunately. I mean, the goal of the novel, as a type of novel, is to be a novel that engages with, current politics and culture. And that's a difficult sort of novel to make, because the world moves so quickly, and novels take a long time to write. And then even after you've finished writing it, probably takes another year before it sees the light of day, and it's a difficult challenge.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking about it. I hope to read it when it comes out. It's supposed to come out in September.
It'll be out in September.
Okay, great. That's David Besmozges, and his novel is called The Betrayers. Once again, set to come out in September. The editor of a popular Russian news website was fired this week because he ran an interview with a pro-Ukrainian nationalist. That editor has been replaced with someone who used to work for a pro-Kremlin publication. This is just the latest example of how Russian President Vladimir Putin is cracking down on any media organizations that don't tout the party line. The number of independent news outlets is shrinking fast. Stephen Ennis is Russia media analyst for BBC Monitoring, which tracks media across the world. Welcome.
Oh, hi.
All right, let's start with what happened most recently. The news site there called Lenta, its editor, a woman, was just fired. What is Lenta? What happened there?
Well, Lenta is one of the best and most popular of Russia's news websites. And Russia's got quite a strange sort of media environment, in the sense that much more than other countries, news websites play an important role in getting sort of objective reporting across to a wide range of readers. Maybe newspapers in Russia are not quite so important, but certainly there are several news websites that are very important, and this was one of the most important, one of the most popular. And Galina Timchenko, who was the editor-in-chief of Lenta.ru, she'd been there since 2004 in her post. She's actually established it as probably the best sort of news website in Russia, and her departure came out of the blue. As you say, it followed an interview that the website had published about with one of the leaders of the Right Sector, which is a Ukrainian ultranationalist group that had been very prominent in the Kiev protests that led to the ousting of Viktor Yanukovych. And this was definitely seen as a political decision. But in fact, it's not the latest development, because hot on the heels of that came news yesterday that three opposition websites have been blocked in Russia. They haven't actually been closed down, I don't think. You can still see them outside Russia, in the UK and the USA. One of them is Kasparov.ru, which is the website set up by Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion, who's also a prominent Russian opposition politician, though he now has fled into exile, fearing for his safety. And also, Russia has blocked the blog of Alexei Navalny, who has emerged as maybe the most potent and charismatic of present Vladimir Putin's opponents. He is currently facing a number of criminal charges, most of which people say which are trumped up, and he's currently under house arrest. And the Russian authorities are saying that having his blog available to readers in Russia is a violation of his house arrest. But in fact, in Russian law, there's no such provision. They seem to be acting completely outside the law when they're blocking this particular blog.
And they're also blocking a television station, an independent television station. It's removed from major cable networks now. So all of this, it seems to be happening very quickly.
It's happening very, very quickly. I kind of went off shift at my work a couple of days ago, and the whole kind of media scene seems to have changed very, very radically in the sort of 36 hours since. What happened with Dozhd, which is, that was set up in 2010, and it's become sort of basically the only kind of really independent TV station in Russia. Nearly all TV stations in Russia, in one way or another, sort of under the control of the Kremlin. Or they don't show any political content. So most of the TV station just pumps out Kremlin propaganda. So, for example, when it comes to the Ukrainian events since November, they've basically been saying that Ukraine is being threatened and is now under the sway of neo-Nazis who are threatening the Russian population and are committing all sorts of atrocities. Nearly all of this is, completely untrue, and it's being used as the pretext for Vladimir Putin's incursion into Crimea. And what is more worrying, I think, and seems to be ever more likely, is the fact that they will invade eastern Ukraine. In fact, yesterday there were clashes in the eastern city of Donetsk, and the Russian foreign ministry said it was caused by Ukrainian nationalists attacking Russians, whereas, in fact, most independent reporters say it was exactly the other way around, and now they're using this as a pretext, possibly, maybe even probably, to make further incursions onto Ukrainian territory. So it's very, very worrying, I think.
And so that information, is that getting to Russians at all, or is that now impossible now that these websites have been blocked?
They're not the only websites that present an alternative point of view, but as you said in your introduction, the number of alternative sources of information are sort of gradually shrinking. There are one or two. So, for example, there's an independent radio station called Echo Moskvy. Now, this came under sort of threat recently, or came under severe criticism, and there was talk that maybe that this would also sort of fall victim to this current round of sort of a media crackdown. But it still sort of presents a sort of what you might call an objective view of what's going on. There's also a newspaper called Novaya Gazeta, which is fiercely anti-Putin, and certainly presents the Ukrainian revolution in a much more positive light. And Dozhd is still available, so you can still watch Dozhd on the net. It's just that its audience is much reduced. And because of this, it's losing all its advertising revenue. And the head of the station has said that it will close within a month, probably, because it's just not a viable commercial proposition anymore.
And so all of this is happening very quickly, as you say, but is it something that Vladimir Putin has wanted to do for a long time, and and he's using this as a pretext to control the media?
It could be. It could also be the prelude to an invasion of Ukraine. It's not really quite clear. Basically, ever since Putin came to power in 2000, he's gradually sort of tightened the grip of the authorities on the media. So it started off with television. So to start with, there were sort of a number of quite powerful independent television stations in Russia. And these were gradually brought under the control of the Kremlin, and all sort of independent presenters on these TV stations, they were gradually forced out of TV. In fact, interestingly, some of them, Yevgeny Kislyov and Savik Shuster, they went to work in Ukraine, where for most of the past decade, the media environment has been a much freer. And interestingly, again, because a lot of the Russian propaganda says that Russian language and Russian speakers are under threat in Ukraine, but these two gentlemen, they both presented shows in Ukraine, and they both presented them speaking Russian. So you had this very unusual situation where often the presenter would be speaking Russian, but most of the audience or the other guests on his program would be answering him in Ukraine. So there'd be this to and froing between the languages. But also some of the guests would also be speaking Russian. So you do have this sort of strange mix.
Stephen Ennis is Russia media analyst for BBC Monitoring. Thank you for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
Coming up on the program, we're going to switch gears. We're going to have our weekly film segment. We'll tell you whether you should spend money to see Veronica Mars, Need for Speed, and Bad Words. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And hey, it's Friday, and Friday is movie time. What's new in the theaters? What's bubbling up in the biz? Christy Lemire is co-host and reviewer for the web show What the Flick, and she's back. Hi.
Hello.
And we have Christian Harloff, co-host of the movie news and culture podcast, Schmoes No.
Thank you for having me.
And that's no, K-N-O-W.
K-N-O-W.
Not Schmoes No.
A lot of people say Schmoes Knows, but that makes no sense if you think about it. It's not,
and it's grammatically incorrect.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's start out with something that maybe doesn't care if it's grammatically incorrect. Need for Speed.
Oof, that's the truth.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear a little bit from the trailer.
She's the boss, right?
What's that?
The boss! The boss, the boss, the boss!
Go to now.
Bus.
Okay, we get it,
bus.
I think.
Yes. The bus, vroom, vroom. That's it. That's your dialogue.
So is this for pre-verbal children?
Yeah, that was actually written in the script. This is rush, vroom, vroom. That was it. Yeah.
You know what? It's a very watered-down version of the Fast and Furious movies. I think it's trying very hard to be those, but also be something Steve McQueen-y like Bullet. I mean, there's actually a reference to Bullet in the film.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I think that because Fast and Furious ultimately was a ripoff of Point Break, and then it just became so successful because what they did well was the chemistry with everyone that was on in those movies as it evolved, and they changed it up. This movie, like Christy said, it tries very hard to do that, but I think it fails on the comedy that they're able to do in the Fast and Furious movies. But if you're going just for car crashes and explosions, you could probably shut your brain off and enjoy it.
Yeah, the bar's not too high, right, when you walk in? So it stars Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad, and this is his first big movie role.
Yes.
So is this his future?
I hope not. Although, you know, there are moments where he brings more substance and more gravitas and better instincts than the material itself probably deserves. But I think even he's a car guy, right? And that's why he was interested in this as a fun movie. I don't necessarily see this as, like, the road he's going to go down, no pun intended.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. I mean, I believe he's going to be in Ridley Scott's next movie from what I hear. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe he's able to expand his acting chops a little more, too. He does. He has a presence. And he's a likable guy, and he absolutely does bring as much as he can to this material.
Okay. Another likable guy, Jason Bateman, and he has a movie out this week that he stars in and directs, and it's called Bad Words. Let's hear a little bit from that.
You're not eligible in any fashion, way, shape, or manner.
Page 39 of the Golden Quill National Spelling Bee Rulebook. This is rule number 24. This is subpoint B. This is a quote. Speller must not have passed beyond the eighth grade on or before February 1st, 2011. That is a rule written by the Governing Institute. And if you want, you can continue to ogle my transcript. Just please don't wrinkle it any further. But you can see there, unfortunately, I have not passed the eighth grade on or before February 1st. Not ever.
So this is about a guy who wants to be in kid spelling bees.
In one particular kid spelling bee, because he has a score to settle. Oh. And he's just misanthropic and racist and mean to kids. And speaking of trying very hard to be a different kind of movie, this is trying very hard to be Bad Santa.
Is it funny?
No.
I loved it. I loved this movie. I thought it was very funny. I thought Jason Bateman crushed it on his directorial debut. I do see the similarities to Bad Santa, but I enjoyed it because I think it had a little bit more heart than Bad Santa ultimately did.
But the heart is tacked on at the end. It's too little too late. And he's such a jerk and such a one-note jerk. Like Billy Bob Thornton in Bad Santa, he's at least an interesting jerk. Like he has self-loathing and self-destruction to him that you'd want to have a beer with him and have a weird night with him. Jason Bateman's just a jerk in this. But the little kid who plays opposite him, I'm going to botch his name, yeah. Rohan Chand.
You'd probably say it better than I
yes.
would.
Yes. Cute little 10-year-old plucky little Indian boy who wants to be his friend and is unflappable in the face of all of his cruelty. He's really cute and he has good instincts, but this movie is just flat and trying so hard to shock us.
Yes. So it sounds like one of those buddy movies, like about a boy.
That's what I liked about it, is the fact you think it's going that way and then it shifts a little bit more. And then by the time, the heart does come at the end, but I think that's because you can't learn exactly what this guy's up to and why he's doing what he's doing. They're trying to figure it out. We're trying to figure it out. And I was satisfied when we figured out why he was doing this. And it's not a Will Ferrell. Like, when you hear 40-year-old guy joins a spelling bee, you're like, okay, Will Ferrell or Jack Black's going to be in this thing. And it's not. And I was pleasantly surprised from seeing it. And, I would recommend it.
I love Jason Bateman, but I don't love this.
Okay. What about Veronica Mars? Also coming out this weekend. And
yes.
Did you like that one?
You know, I did, and I had never seen the TV show, but you don't need to have seen the TV show to watch it, because there's a quick little prologue, like, here's who I used to be, and here's who I am now, and so it catches you up. It had this great cult following. It had this unprecedented Kickstarter campaign, which is why it exists in theaters today. And Kristen Bell is just lovely and has great snappy banter and a really likable, very highly verbal presence about her. It's cute.
So give us the rundown, the plot summary. What is it?
Okay, so she was girl detective alongside her dad in high school at a small beach town in California. This is 9-10 years later. She's about to become a lawyer, but when a pop star is murdered in her hometown, she has to come back and solve the case. And she gets wrapped back in her life again.
I haven't seen or spoken to Logan in 9 years.
Veronica!
I heard he got his life together, then suddenly he's all over the gossip pages.
Come on now, honey.
Son of a movie star dates pop star. Son of a movie star beats up paparazzi. Caught on camera. Son of a movie star threatens celebrity girlfriend's life.
Christian, what did you think?
I haven't seen it yet, but it's funny, though, too, because I actually worked at Joel Silver's company when the show was on the air, and I had never watched an episode. but from what I hear, everyone that watched it really enjoyed it, and I love what they did with the Kickstarter campaign, because they kind of started this whole thing that everyone, then Zach Braff jumped on board and everybody started doing it. But I like Kristen Bell very much. I'm curious to see how it turned out.
Okay, you also saw a movie that, Christy, you didn't see this week, Enemy.
Yes.
With Jake Gyllenhaal.
This movie is not your conventional type of film. It is not a movie that you can predict. It's not a movie by the time you get to the end, you go, okay, I saw where that was coming. You have to revisit it a bunch of times. It's based off of a novel, with liberties, of course. But the last shot, you're going to be like, wait, what? And what does it all mean? It's not for everybody, but if you want to think and go, oh, wait, mate, it's like a puzzle.
Ultimately, so it's a puzzle because it is two people who look exactly alike, both played by Jake Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal is kind of like he's a teacher, kind of really nothing going on. He's got a girlfriend, and there's just, you know, he's going through the steps of life. And one day he rents a movie, he sees someone who looks exactly like him, and he has to go find this person.
And let me guess, good seed, bad seed.
Yes, but again, yes, but it's not that black and white.
So you recommend it.
For some people, yes, not for everyone.
What kind of people?
Sounds like it's very mysterious.
Because that's what the movie is. The movie's mysterious. It's one of those things. Again, if you like a little something a little different, a little more of an independent taste, this is your movie.
Okay, what about The Birds? Now that was a great movie made by Alfred Hitchcock 1,000 years ago. What, 1963, I think. And now Michael Bay wants to remake it.
This is a frightening concept to me. No one should touch the birds, but Michael Bay really should not touch the birds. Are they transforming birds?
Ba-dum-bum.
Were they helicopters first?
Right.
I don't want to know about this.
Yeah, next Stephen Sommers is going to do Citizen Kane. I mean, it's like...
So wrong.
No, don't touch it. First of all, absolutely right. Do not touch it because it's a classic. Second of all, Michael Bay is just the hackiest hack of the hackiest hack. Stop.
Well, is it actually going to happen, or is it just a fantasy?
I think it's a nightmare.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, listen.
A horror movie.
I hope not.
So.
Right. And we talked about West Side Story possibly being remade last week and by Steven Spielberg. And really, these movies, let's let them rest in peace.
Yeah, leave it alone.
I wonder who it's for, though. I don't think these are for the original audiences of these films, because we all have such love for the original source material. Who is this for?
Right.
A new generation? Show them the original.
Yeah, no, exactly. And what are they going to do? Because one of the beauties of the original Birds, there's no score. And it's one of the only Hitchcock films that doesn't have a score in it. You know Michael Bay is going to hire someone and make it, no, go big, go huge. And it's like, no, you don't need to do that. That's what was so great about Hitchcock was he'd settle, but then he'd hit you real hard. And there's only one style with Michael Bay, and that's boom. So pass.
It's for the birds. I had to say it. Christy Lemire, co-host of the web show What the Flick, and Christian Harloff, co-founder of the movies and culture website Schmoes No. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, we conclude our series on the business of death with a visit to a death doula. First, a news update with KCRW's Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and we're reporting on the business of death. Yesterday, in the first part of our series, we examined the multi-billion-dollar funeral industry. That industry came about when funerals were taken out of the home and professionalized. These days, most people die in hospitals and long-term care facilities. And when they do, an ambulance shows up to whisk them away to a funeral parlor. But there is another way, and maybe it's about going back to the past. Death at home, with the funeral right there, presided over by someone called a death doula. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez explains.
Knock, knock.
Yeah.
Hello, darling.
This is Richard Wood's bedroom in Santa Monica. It's small and cozy, and he's surrounded by art. During his 80 years of life, Richard's been the freest of free spirits, a writer, an artist, a dabbler in many religions. He's even served a stint in prison. And now, well, now, he's dying.
You feeling okay?
Oh, I've had better days.
A terminal illness has left Richard's body frail. You can almost put your hands around his waist. But it hasn't robbed Richard of his sense of humor.
Well, yeah, I thought I'd be dead already. I made plans. For the other side, I'm still here. And it's embarrassing. Rena and other people go out, oh, how's Richard? Is he still alive?
Joining me at Richard's bedside is Olivia Rose Barham, a woman with a very unusual job. She's a death midwife. Now, if a birth midwife leads you out of the womb, a death midwife leads you to the tomb.
He'll lay here.
Here in this.
On this bed. He'll stay right here where he goes, yeah.
Olivia explains what will happen to Richard once he dies.
We won't move him at all until the third day, and then we'll put him into that gold box, the cardboard box, and then he will be in there during the ceremony, which will probably take place in the back. They have a beautiful back open garage in there.
Olivia is one of a very small number of death midwives in the United States. The midwives teach family and friends of the soon-to-be deceased how to do much of the same work that's usually done by a funeral home.
That means I guide them in how to bathe, dress, anoint, and find a place in the home to lay the body in honor. Then the home turns into a beautiful shrine for 3 days. I hold the family during that process so that they can embrace what just happened and integrate this enormous thing called death of their loved one into their lives.
It's a common misconception that when someone dies, you have to call the guys in the white coats to pick them up right away. But in most states, including this one, people are actually permitted to keep their loved ones at home for a few days and provide some degree of after-death care. And the death midwife, some people call them death doulas, are there to help.
It's really quite simple. The eyes will just naturally close by themselves if you do it immediately after they've passed. If for some reason they stay open a little bit, you can weigh them down.
Olivia charges about $1,000 for her services. That seems like a deal compared to the $5,000 to $10,000 you might pay at a funeral home. And she does house calls. To get to her clients as quickly as possible after they pass, she keeps a death midwife kit neatly packed and by her front door.
The kit and everything that it contains.
So it's a standard black travel bag that you'd see in any airport. And inside it's, well, describe it.
There's a shaving kit.
Let's see,
And brush and comb.
Toiletries.
Toiletries, safety pins. Lots of washcloths, and these are the shampoos and the soap. These are essential oils to make sure that the body smells really beautiful.
Yes, the smell. Olivia says thoroughly cleaning the body and having plenty of dry ice on hand slows decomposition and the associated unpleasant odor.
It's surprising how accustomed you can get to having the body in the house pretty quickly, I'd imagine.
Oh, yes, very quickly. As soon as it's there, people go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I was even afraid of this. Isn't he beautiful? Oh, my gosh.
Many death midwives, including Olivia, aren't officially accredited or even formally trained. But some of their work isn't especially technical anyway, like putting together the at-home ceremony. Usually, there are no black veils or organ music, and the body of the departed is right out there for everyone to see.
I don't want to use the word funeral. Just my semantic hang-up. I don't like funerals.
No.
I won't show up for my funeral.
Give me another word that I can use for it, then.
I want people to celebrate my passing. I want them to celebrate the things they remember about me, or some may recall incidents knowing me they'd prefer not to remember. I'm sure that is possible also.
A lot of times, the dying help plan the after party. And that's the case with Richard.
We'll start out with Led Zeppelin and then move out from there.
Cool.
Well, and people would expect it from me.
Mm-hmm. You want Stairway to Heaven?
Well, yeah. Well, that's probably the one we should start with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Olivia does her work mostly out of dissatisfaction with how her own mother's body was treated after death. It was too cold and too bureaucratic for her. For his part, Richard isn't close to his family, and he's a widower who's mostly on his own, other than a small circle of friends. So he's decided that a dignified, personalized death ceremony at home, one arranged by Olivia, is a perfect bon voyage.
The fear of passing, I'm looking forward to it. I've been rehearsing for the big sleep for years. It's been a sweet surrender. I'm ready as we speak.
It'd be hard to say goodbye to him.
Yeah. You can't help but feel so much love. Yeah, that'll be hard. This has been my hardest, I think.
At-home funerals are still the exception rather than the rule, but they hint at changing attitudes about death in America. One of the people set on changing our attitudes is Caitlin Doty. She's a Los Angeles-based mortician, and she's known for her Ask a Mortician YouTube channel. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
All right, so does what you just heard sound like a typical death doula relationship?
Yeah, the idea is to have the family involved as much as possible. So it really depends on the level of comfort for the family. Some families may want to keep the body at home but aren't totally comfortable washing or some of the more logistical things that need to happen. So they want someone there who's done it before. But if a family is really comfortable and has done their research and gone online, they don't really need anyone at all. They can handle it entirely on their own.
Oh, really? And so how do they learn how to do that?
There are websites that you can go to. If you just Google home funeral, really, there'll be all sorts of resources. There's a really great one in Canada that has YouTube videos. So it's very accessible. The information is definitely out there. But a home funeral is something that you have to plan for in advance. It can't just be like someone dies and you're like, you know what, let's just keep them at home. Because there are things that you do need to plan for.
Well, yeah. And I assume there are also you know, sanitation issues and health issues. And I'm wondering, are there any laws governing this in terms of a dying body in your house and what happens with,
Right. Well, they want, as far as laws, they definitely want something within about 72 hours. They want there to be some sort of action towards, you know, doing something with the body, whether it be moving towards cremation or at least under cold storage or burial. But the idea that the dead body is really dangerous is kind of a cultural untruth or something that's been built up over many years. And a dead body really is no more dangerous than a living one. In fact, it's actually safer than a living body. You'd be better off in a whole room full of corpses than you would sitting next to one person with a cold on an airplane. So it's really not, it's not like, you know, unless somebody died of like avian bird flu or something wildly contagious, which wouldn't die at home, a person like that wouldn't die at home. There's nothing that a dead body can really give you. And nobody's ever got a disease from a dead body that they took care of in their home.
Well, but there is, I hate to say it, the ick factor, decomposition. When does a body start to really decompose and pose a problem?
Well, in home funerals, the suggested way to do it is to have dry ice. So any sort of refrigeration or dry ice really severely retards the decomposition process. So, you know, basically what's happening when you die is the little bacteria that are in your body normally realize that there's nothing new for them. And so they start trying to eat their way out. And that's what, that's where gas comes from and bloating and the smell. But if there's some sort of cold around them, it really slows those bacteria down and decomposition takes much, much longer.
Like how long?
Well, under dry, I mean, normally, I mean, it depends on what people's comfort level is, but home funerals, usually, it's usually a 2 to 3, anywhere from 1 day to 3 days. Although it can go longer if there's a lot of dry ice and a lot of care given to the body. And also depends on whether or not you're in a tropical humid environment versus Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in Los Angeles, are there any laws governing this? Any codes that we need to be aware of?
There are some codes. Technically, people are not supposed to accept money for taking care of a dead body unless they're with a licensed funeral home. So that's why a lot of doulas will be donation-based. And as far as taking care of the body yourself, there's really not a law. California is actually pretty good about having laws on the book saying that you don't need to use a funeral home to take care of the body yourself. Of course, you can't do a cremation yourself or you can't do a burial yourself. You will need to involve other people. But as far as the first couple of days after death and that sort of care, you're completely empowered to do that yourself.
What about burying? What about burying the body outside? Let's say you have a big chunk of land and you'd like to bury your loved one under his or her favorite tree outside.
That's really, really difficult in California, especially in urban areas. There are some states, and it's state by state, there are some states like Texas, which it's a lot easier, but in California, they actually tried to bury Michael Jackson on Neverland Ranch, and even with all of his team of lawyers and Arnold Schwarzenegger advocating for it, they still couldn't get the permits from the county to do it. So in Los Angeles, it's impossible, basically, and in most counties, it can be incredibly difficult, but it goes by a county-by-county basis.
How big is this in terms of a trend of people having at-home funerals versus being in a funeral parlor?
It's definitely a trend. I don't think the funeral industry is necessarily quaking in their boots yet. Cremation and direct cremation with no services at all is considered the much bigger threat. But home funerals are really sort of a more cultural, intellectual threat to the funeral industry because it goes against what the funeral industry is built on. And the industry wants the public to think that they are needed, even though they have the stigma of charging money for death. But a home funeral says, we don't need funeral homes. We can do this ourselves. And it's actually very empowering and life-affirming to engage with our own dead.
You're a mortician.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you operate?
I'm starting to do home funerals and I'm starting a business in that way. And I'm not doing this because I think that there's this awesome business opportunity there. I'm doing it because I think it's hypocritical for me to believe what I believe, which is that family shouldn't be involved with the corpse for the good of our society, and still pick up a paycheck every other week from an old guard funeral home.
And so do you think that there's a way that we can begin to shift the way we think of death and the way we've sort of, over many decades, outsourced it. And I guess out of sight, out of mind, we don't even want to physically touch a dead body. Do you think that we can, as Americans, actually change our attitudes about this?
I do. I absolutely do think we can, but I think it's up to people like me and the other people who do similar work that I do to make it, to make the benefits clear and to make the options clear. Because it's kind of a hard sell. When you've lived in a culture for so long that has pushed death away and made it professional and made it for not for you, there are professionals who handle that. It's really a big leap to say, yes, I'm going to, my father died and he took care of me my whole life and I'm going to take care of him now, even though I have this sort of freaked out feeling that his dead body is going to be weird or strange or gross in some way. But for the people who have done, I've never spoken to anyone who's done a home funeral or has taken care of the dead themselves, who at the end has said, "Ugh, I wish I hadn't have done that. That was actually really terrible." For the most part, everybody thinks that it was a wonderful, affirming experience.
Mm. Well, Caitlin Doty, thank you so much. That was really interesting.
Thank you.
Caitlin Doty is a Los Angeles-based mortician and founder of a collective called the Order of the Good Death, where they say they explore ways to prepare a death-phobic culture for their inevitable mortality. You can check it out at orderofthegooddeath.com or on Caitlin's YouTube channel, Ask a Mortician. Okay, let's ask a Warren about what's coming on to the point at 1 o'clock.
We are going to be talking about the 25th anniversary of the web. Rather hard to believe that it's that old,
it
but
is,
it is.
Or
and
that we
if
are.
You'll remember that when it first came around, everybody thought this was going to be this wonderful democratizing institution mm-hmm. that would lead to the free flow of information everywhere. Well, as it becomes truly worldwide, that is less and less the case. For example, there are now 500 million users in China alone. That's more than the population of the United States. And, of course, there is a very careful supervision of the Internet there, censorship. And, of course, we have our problems with privacy. So there's a lot to talk about.
Interesting. That's coming up in, about 12 minutes from now, to the point. Thank you, Warren Olney.
All right.
Have a great weekend.
See you too.
And coming up on this program, what happened to that Malaysian Airlines plane that disappeared a week ago? We'll run down the theories, including the latest, some kind of hijacking. That's the latest theory. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 6 days ago, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, flying with 239 passengers on board from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, disappeared. The mystery surrounding what happened to the flight continues to deepen, and every day seems to bring a different theory. The latest, the plane was possibly hijacked, or maybe lithium batteries brought the plane down. Andy Pastor is here now. He covers aviation for the Wall Street Journal, and he's based here in Los Angeles. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, it really is hard to keep up with all the changing theories. Tell us more about the latest.
Well, that's right. It's been a very fast-moving story, but I think it's increasingly clear that this is morphing into a criminal investigation, some kind of law enforcement investigation. There are too many signs currently that there were intentional acts on the aircraft to turn off tracking devices, to turn off devices that would allow others to know where the plane was, and none of that fits with any kind of an accident scenario. So I would say that you're looking at this point, not a formal declaration that a criminal act has been committed, but we're definitely headed in that direction, and unfortunately that raises all sorts of new questions and challenges about who's going to lead it and how well they'll do that and what role the U.S. will play. And things are still very fluid. Of course, there's been no debris found, there's been no wreckage found, but I do think that the theorizing is going to stop and you're going to start seeing more of a criminal focus.
Well, that was the focus initially with two Iranians on board with stolen passports. Are they now being reconsidered as possibly involved?
Well, there's very little information coming out about who in fact may be the focus of any criminal probe. And I think at this point, the investigators themselves, I mean, they're just starting to get into it. Very premature, and I think not too smart to focus on some people with passports that may have been stolen and jump to the conclusion that they were, you know, a party to some hijacking or commandeering. It's clear, though, that either a pilot or a number of people on board intended to take this plane off its intended course, and they did that, and then at the very end of this flight, 5 hours after it disappeared from civil air traffic control radar, 5 hours after that, they disabled the last system, which was still communicating with some satellites and providing speed and altitude indications, and they disabled that system, and from there, it's just not clear where the plane went, whether it landed anywhere, which is unlikely, or crashed somewhere, but we have no debris, so it's still quite a mystery.
Yeah, 5 hours, that could be 3,000 miles in any direction.
Almost, that's right, Mel.
So unlikely that it landed anywhere because it is such a large aircraft.
Yes, and I mean, it's hard to see how it could evade military radars and air defense systems in those surrounding countries. But this is just such a weird chain of events, really unprecedented. We use that word a lot, but today for this investigation and for this case, it really holds true. There's nothing been like this that has been shown up in modern civil aviation in many, many, many decades, perhaps ever. So I don't think we should rule out the possibility that it could have landed somewhere, and certainly investigators have not. But there's only one incontrovertible fact in all of this. If an airplane of this size goes into the water, you have to have debris. Something is going to float. Seat cushions, parts of the galley, something from the overhead. That's just a fact. And we haven't found anything, so either we're looking in the wrong place or it never made it into the water.
Mm. And, well, the oceans are vast. So
that's right.
Well, okay, so which countries are actively searching, and what role does the United States play in this?
There's a host of countries actively searching. China has provided some resources. The Indians are now starting to. Thailand, certainly the Malaysians, the Australians have even provided some resources, and the U.S., some significant resources, sophisticated planes and aircraft. They haven't found anything so far, but I think we should be, we should keep our eyes on the ball, and that is whether or not wreckage is found, someone is going to lead this investigation, and if it turns into a criminal investigation, I think the Malaysians have shown themselves not in the best light so far. They haven't been terribly organized. There have been lots of mixed messages and confusion, and I'm starting to hear a lot of aviation experts talk about how it may be problematic, really, for the Malaysians to take the lead. It'll be a multi-country investigation, and the U.S. will provide expertise. I think the FBI will be the main source of the expertise if it's a criminal probe, but the National Transportation Safety Board and the FAA will provide technical help. But I think it's going to be a challenge. The Malaysians have never had to cope with anything nearly this big, this important, this challenging for them.
And you're saying that they wouldn't, or the aviation experts are saying that they're not necessarily credible in terms of leading this investigation because they're not able to technically, or they would be unwilling to?
No, I think the concern is they don't have the resources and the institutional, wherewithal to do it in an organized way with all the pressures and friction and problems that are sure to crop up.
Andy Pastor, correspondent for the Wall Street Journal Los Angeles Bureau covering aviation. Thanks for updating us on this story.
Thanks so much for having me.
And here she is, Jolie Myers with the mail. Hi.
I've got the mail, but guess what else I have, Madeline?
What?
Baby gorilla pictures. Cherry Glazer is talking about the baby gorilla born by C-section at the San Diego Wildlife Park. And I tweeted out a link to the pictures because I know you want to see them at KCRW Press Play. Check them out. For the rest of the feedback segment, yeah. I know I can't top that, but we had a lot of comments about our Herbalife segment yesterday. I asked you to play a little free association game with us on Facebook, you meaning listeners. I asked when I say Herbalife, you say, and people could respond, protein shake or pyramid scheme or Batman or whatever. And Nate Amick answered simply Scientology. Katie Brad said mall kiosk. Isabel Angel said the thing written on the Galaxy jerseys. Apparently they
Sponsor the Galaxy.
Exactly,
yeah.
The soccer team. And Jason Thompson said kidney damage.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what that means, but okay.
It's free association.
I'm going to say baby gorilla. That's what I'm going to say.
That's my answer to everything for the rest of the day. Maria Angelis shared a story about Herbalife. She told us that one time she accidentally attended an Herbalife recruiting meeting. Mm-hmm. She said she saw an ad on Craigslist asking for health coaches. When she showed up to the job interview, in quotation marks, it was not a job interview. It was a recruiting session for new Herbalife salespeople. Alas, not the job that she was hoping to get.
All right. Well, I think we're off the job now. This is the end of the show. Jolie Myers, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you. And you, listeners, have a great weekend. You can contact us, leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or email pressplay@kcrw.com. And we're on Twitter, @KCRWPressPlay. I am @TheMadBrand. That's it for me, Warren Olney. And To The Point, up next, have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.